The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I will read the article from the March 11th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine that prompted the Democratic National Committee to reject Fox News for future presidential debates. From the A Reporter at Large department, an article entitled Trump TV. Fox News has always been partisan, but has it become propaganda? By Jane Mayer. Note, this has been edited for length for this broadcast. In January, during the longest government shutdown in America's history, President Donald Trump rode in a motorcade through Hidalgo County, Texas, eventually stopping on a grassy bluff overlooking the Rio Grande. The White House wanted to dramatize what Trump was portraying as a national emergency, the need to build a wall along the Mexican border. The presence of armored vehicles, bales of confiscated marijuana, and federal agents in flak jackets underscored the message. But the photo op dramatized something else about the administration. After members of the press pool got out of vans and headed over to where the president was about to speak, they noticed that Sean Hannity, the Fox News host, was already on location. Unlike them, he hadn't been confined by the Secret Service and was mingling with administration officials, at one point hugging Kirstjen Nielsen, the Secretary of Homeland Security. The Poole report noted that Hannity was seen, quote, huddling, end quote, with the White House Communications Director, Bill Shine. After the photo op, Hannity had an exclusive on-air interview with Trump. Politico later reported that it was Hannity's seventh interview with the president and Fox's 42nd. Since then, Trump has given Fox two more. He has granted only 10 to the three other main television networks combined and none to CNN, which he denounces as fake news. Hannity was treated in Texas like a member of the administration because he virtually is one. The same can be said of Fox's chairman, Rupert Murdoch. Fox has long been a bane of liberals, but in the past 2 years, many people who watch the network closely, including some Fox alumni, say that it has evolved into something that hasn't existed before in the United States. Nicole Hemmer, an assistant professor of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and the author of Messengers of the Right, A History of the Conservative Media's Impact on American Politics, says of Fox, "It's the closest we have come to having state TV." Hemmer argues that Fox, which, as the most watched cable news network, generates about $2.7 billion a year for its parent company, 21st Century Fox, acts as a force multiplier for Trump, solidifying his hold over the Republican Party and intensifying his support. Fox is not just taking the temperature of the base, it's raising the temperature, she says. It's a radicalization model. For both Trump and Fox, fear is a business strategy. It keeps people watching. As the president has been beset by scandals, congressional hearings, and even talk of impeachment, Fox has been both his shield and his sword. The White House and Fox interact so seamlessly that it can be hard to determine, during a particular news cycle, which one is following the other's lead. All day long, Trump retweets claims made on the network. His press secretary, Sarah Sanders, has largely stopped holding press conferences, but she has made some 30 appearances on such shows as Fox and Friends and Hannity. Trump, Hemmer says, has almost become a programmer. Fox's defenders view such criticism as unfounded and politically biased. Ken LaCourte, who was in senior management at Fox News for nearly 20 years until 2016, and recently started his own news service, told me, "The people at Fox said the same thing about the press and Obama." Fox's public relations department offers numerous examples of its reporters and talk show hosts challenging the administration. Chris Wallace, a tough-minded and ecumenical interviewer, recently grilled Stephen Miller, a senior Trump advisor, on the need for a border wall, given that virtually all drugs seized at the border are discovered at checkpoints. Trump is not the first president to have a favorite media organization. James Madison and Andrew Jackson were each boosted by partisan newspapers. But many people who have watched and worked with Fox over the years, including some leading conservatives, regard Fox's deepening Trump orthodoxy with alarm. Bill Kristol, who was a paid contributor to Fox News until 2012 and is a prominent never-Trumper, said of the network, "It's changed a lot. Before it was conservative, but it wasn't crazy. Now it's just propaganda." Joe Peronin, a professor of journalism at NYU, was an early president of Fox News in the mid-90s. "I've never seen anything like it before," he says of Fox. "It's as if the president had his own press organization. It is not healthy." Nothing has formalized the partnership between Fox and Trump more than the appointment in July 2018 of Bill Shine, the former co-president of Fox News, as director of communications and deputy chief of staff at the White House. Bill Kristol says of Shine, "When I first met him, he was producing Hannity's show at Fox, and the two were incredibly close." Both come from white working-class families on Long Island, and they are godfathers to each other's children, who refer to them as Uncle Bill and Uncle Sean. Another former colleague says, "They spend their vacations together." And a third recalls, "I was rarely in Shine's office when Sean didn't call, and I was in Shine's office a lot. They talked all the time, many times a day." Shine led Fox News programming division for a dozen years, overseeing the morning and evening opinion shows, which collectively get the biggest ratings and define the network's conservative brand. Straight news was not within his purview. In July 2016, Roger Ailes, the co-founder and CEO of Fox, was fired in the face of numerous allegations of chronic sexual harassment, and Shine became co-president. But within a year, he too had been forced out amid a second wave of sexual harassment allegations, some of them against Fox's biggest stars at the time, Bill O'Reilly. Shine wasn't personally accused of sexual harassment, but several lawsuits named him as complicit in a workplace culture of cover-ups, payoffs, and victim intimidation. Shine, who has denied any wrongdoing, has kept a low profile at the White House and rejects interview requests, including one from this magazine. But Kristol contends that Shine's White House appointment is a scandal. "It's been widely undercovered," he said. "It's astounding that Shine, the guy who covered up Ailes' horrible behavior, is the deputy chief of staff." With Shine, the Fox and White House payrolls actually do overlap. The Hollywood Reporter obtained financial disclosure forms revealing that Fox has been paying Shine millions of dollars since he joined the administration. Last year, he collected the first half of a $7 million bonus that he was owed after resigning from Fox. This year, he will collect the remainder. That sum is in addition to a $8.4 million severance payment that he received upon leaving the network. In December, four Democratic senators sent a letter to the White House counsel's office demanding proof that Fox's payments to Shine don't violate federal ethics and conflict of interest statutes. Schein is only the most recent Fox News alumnus to join the Trump administration. Among others, Trump appointed the former Fox contributor Ben Carson to be his Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, the former Fox commentator John Bolton to be his National Security Advisor, and the former Fox commentator K.T. McFarland to be his Deputy National Security Advisor. McFarland resigned after 4 months. Trump recently picked the former Fox News anchor Heather Nauert to be the ambassador of the United Nations, but she soon withdrew herself from consideration, reportedly because her nanny, an immigrant, lacked a work permit. Well, the White House door swings both ways. Hope Hicks, Schein's predecessor in the communications job, is now the top public relations officer at 21st Century Fox. Several others who have left the Trump White House, including Sebastian Gorka, a former advisor on national security, regularly appear on Fox. Gorka recently insisted on Fox Business that one of Trump's biggest setbacks, retreating from the shutdown without securing border wall funds, was actually a, quote, masterstroke, end quote. Other former Fox News celebrities have practically become part of the Trump family. Kimberly Guilfoyle, a former co-host of The Five, left Fox in July. She's now working on Trump's re-election campaign and dating Donald Trump Jr. She left the network mid-contract after a former Fox employee threatened to sue the network for harassment and accused Guilfoyle of sharing lewd images, among other misconduct. Fox and the former employee reached a multi-million dollar settlement. A lawyer who represents Guilfoyle said that any suggestion that she engaged in misconduct at Fox is patently false. Pete Hegseth and Lou Dobbs, hosts on Fox Business, have each been patched into Oval Office meetings by speakerphone to offer policy advice. Sean Hannity has told colleagues that he speaks to the president virtually every night after his show ends at 10 p.m. According to the Washington Post, White House advisors have taken to calling Hannity the shadow chief of staff. A Republican political expert who has a paid contract with Fox News told me that Hannity has essentially become a West Wing advisor, attributing this development in part to the utter breakdown of any normal decision-making in the White House. The expert added, "The place has gone off the rails. There is no ordinary policy development system." As a result, he said, Fox's on-air personalities are, quote, filling the vacuum, end quote. It's hardly unprecedented for American media barons to go beyond their pages to try to influence the course of politics. At the 1960 Democratic National Convention, Philip Graham, the co-owner of the Washington Post, helped broker a deal in which John F. Kennedy selected Lyndon Johnson as his running mate. But now, a direct pipeline has been established between the Oval Office and the office of Rupert Murdoch, the Australian-born billionaire who founded News Corp and 21st Century Fox. Multiple sources told me that Murdoch and Trump often talk on the phone. A former aide to Trump who has been in the Oval Office when Murdoch has called says, quote, "It's two men who've known each other for a very long time having frank conversations. The president certainly doesn't kowtow to Murdoch, but Murdoch also doesn't to him. He speaks to him the same way he would have 5 years ago," end quote. According to Michael Wolff's 2018 book, Fire and Fury, Murdoch derided Trump as a effing idiot after a conversation about immigration. The aide says Trump knows that Murdoch has denigrated him behind his back, but it doesn't seem to matter that much. Several sources confirmed to me that Murdoch regales friends with Trump's latest inanities. But Murdoch, arguably the most powerful media mogul in the world, is an invaluable ally to any politician. Having Murdoch's and Fox's support is essential for Trump, the aide says. Quote, it's very important for the base, end quote. Murdoch may be even closer to Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Well-informed sources say that Kushner, an increasingly valued White House advisor, has worked hard to win over Murdoch, showing him respect and asking him for advice. Kushner has regularly assured Murdoch that the White House is a smooth-running operation, despite many reports suggesting that it is chaotic. Kushner now has an almost filial status with Murdoch, who turns 88 this month, and numerous sources told me that they communicate frequently. Like every day, one said. Trump became famous in no small part because of Rupert Murdoch. After Murdoch bought the New York Post in 1976, he was introduced to Trump through a mutual acquaintance, Roy Cohn, the infamous legal fixer who, as a young man, was Senator Joseph McCarthy's chief counsel. Cohn saw the potential for tabloid synergy. Trump could obtain celebrity in the pages of the Post as a playboy mogul, and Murdoch could sell papers by chronicling Trump's exploits. Murdoch could not have foreseen that Trump would become president, but he was a visionary about the niche audience that became Trump's base. In 1994, Murdoch laid out an audacious plan to Reed Hundt, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission under President Bill Clinton. Murdoch, who had been a U.S. citizen for less than a decade, invited Hundt to his Benedict Canyon estate for dinner. After the meal, Murdoch led him outside to take in the glittering view of the Los Angeles basin and confided that he planned to launch a radical new television network. Unlike the three established networks, which vied for the same centrist viewers, his creation would follow the unapologetically lowbrow model of the tabloids that he published in Australia and England and appeal to a narrow audience that would be entirely his. His core viewers, he said, would be football fans. With his aim in mind, he had just bought the rights to broadcast NFL games. Hunt told me what he was really saying was that he was going after a working-class audience. He was going to carve out a base that would become the Trump base. Hunt recalled the conversation as, quote, overwhelming, end quote. He said, I was at this house more expensive than any I could ever imagine. This person's made a huge mark in two other countries, and he had entered our country and was saying, I'm going to break up the three-party oligopoly that has governed the most important medium of communication for politics and policy in this country since the Second World War. It was like some scene from Faust. What came to my mind was Mephistopheles. In 1996, Murdoch hired Roger Ailes to create a conservative TV news outlet. Ailes, who died in 2017, was a master of attack politics and wedge issues, having been a media consultant on several of America's dirtiest and most divisive campaigns, including those of Richard Nixon. Ailes invented programming, Levin argues, quote, that confirmed all your worst instincts. Fox News' fundamental business model is driving fear, end quote. The formula worked spectacularly well. By 2002, Fox had displaced CNN as the highest-rated cable news network, and it has remained on top ever since. In 2011, at Ailes' invitation, Trump began making weekly guest appearances on the morning show Fox and Friends. In a trial run of his campaign tactics, he used the channel as a platform to exploit racist suspicions about President Barack Obama, spreading doubt about whether he was born in America. In one segment, Trump suggested that Obama's, quote, family doesn't even know what hospital he was born in, end quote. As Hunt sees it, quote, Murdoch didn't invent Trump, but he invented the audience. Murdoch was going to make a Trump exist, and then Trump comes along, sees all these people, and says, I'll be the ringmaster in your circus, end quote. Trump's arrival marked an important shift in tone at Fox. Until then, the network had largely mocked birtherism as a conspiracy theory. O'Reilly called its promoters unhinged, and Glenn Beck, who at the time also hosted a Fox show, called them, quote, idiots. But Trump gave birtherism national exposure, and in a sign of things to come, Hannity fanned the flames. Hannity began saying that, although he thought that Obama had been born in the United States, the circumstances surrounding his birth certificate were odd. Fox's hostility toward the Obama administration grew increasingly extreme. Its coverage of the Benghazi debacle, a tragic embassy ambush not unlike others that had claimed American lives in previous administrations, devolved into a relentless attack on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In certain instances, however, Fox executives enforced journalistic limits. The network canceled Beck's show in 2011 because his paranoid rants had become too embarrassing. Among other things, Beck accused the White House science advisor of having proposed stemming population growth through forced abortions and sterilants in the water. At the height of the Tea Party rebellion, Ailes reprimanded Hannity for violating the line between journalism and politics. Hannity had arranged to tape his evening Fox show at a Tea Party fundraiser in Ohio. When Ailes learned of the plan only hours before the event, he demanded that Hannity cancel his appearance. According to a former Fox executive, Ailes then blew up at Bill Shine, who had authorized Hannity's trip. The former executive said, recalling that Ailes yelled, "No one at Fox is shilling for the Tea Party." Roger was livid and ripped the S-word out of Shine. Afterward, Shine released a statement criticizing Hannity's actions. And Murdoch, at a panel about the news, expressed a similar view, saying, "I don't think we should be supporting the Tea Party or any other party." Such niceties no longer apply. In November, Hannity joined Trump on stage at a climactic rally for the midterm elections. Afterward, Fox issued a limp statement saying that it didn't condone any talent participating in campaign events and that the, quote, unfortunate distraction, end quote, had, quote, been addressed, end quote. Many Fox News reporters were angry and provided critical anonymous quotes to the media. But Hannity didn't apologize, saying that he had been surprised yet honored when Trump called him up on stage. This response was dubious. Before the rally, Trump's campaign had advertised Hannity as a, quote, special guest, end quote. When Hannity joined Trump, he not only praised him for, quote, promises kept, end quote, he also echoed the president's attacks on the press, castigating the rest of the media covering the rally as fake news. The evening ended with a high five between Hannity and Shine, who had recently started working at the White House. Although Ailes paid occasional lip service to journalistic integrity, Fox News was hardly fair and balanced under his leadership. Gabriel Sherman, in his biography, The Loudest Voice in the Room, reports that Ailes was so obsessed with bringing down Obama in 2012 that he declared to colleagues, "I want to elect the next president." Yet, during the 2016 campaign, Fox executives were initially uneasy about Trump's candidacy. Murdoch tweeted that Trump was embarrassing his friends and the whole country. An editorial in the Wall Street Journal, Murdoch's flagship newspaper, called Trump's candidacy a catastrophe. Murdoch, an immigrant himself, bridled at Trump's xenophobia. In 2015, when Trump claimed that most immigrants coming from Mexico were criminals and rapists, Murdoch corrected him on Twitter, noting that, quote, Mexican immigrants, as with all immigrants, have much lower crime rates than native-born, end quote. He also tweeted that El Paso was, quote, the safest city in America, end quote. Murdoch's views could scarcely be more at odds with Fox's current diatribes about hordes of illegal aliens who are invading the U.S. and killing innocent Americans, leaving behind grieving angel moms and angel dads. Van Susteren told me that she wasn't surprised by this rhetorical turn. Don't kid yourself about his support for immigration, he said of Murdoch. She said of Murdoch, Rupert is first about the bottom line. They're all going out to play to their crowd, whether it's Fox or MSNBC. After leaving Fox, Van Susteren was for a short time a host on MSNBC. Fox's mile-by-mile coverage of the so-called migrant caravan was an enormous hit. Ratings in October 2018 exceeded those of October 2016, the height of the presidential campaign. Fox's embrace of Trumpism took some time. Sherman has reported that when the network hosted the first Republican presidential debate in August 2015 in Cleveland, Murdoch advised Ailes to make sure that the moderators hit Trump hard. This put Ailes in an awkward position. Trump drew tremendous ratings and had fervent supporters, and Ailes was afraid of losing that audience to rival media outlets. Breitbart, the alt-right website led by Stephen K. Bannon, was generating huge traffic by championing Trump. What's more, Ailes and Trump were friendly. They spoke all the time, a former Fox executive says. They had lunch shortly before Trump announced his candidacy, and Ailes gave Trump political tips during the primaries. Ken LaCourte contends that Ailes took note of Trump's crazy behavior, but Trump's growing political strength was also obvious. According to the former Fox executive, Trump made Ailes nervous. He thought Trump was a wild card, someone Ailes could not bully or intimidate. In the summer of 2016, 2 weeks before Trump secured the Republican nomination, Gretchen Carlson, the former co-host of Fox and Friends, sued Ailes for sexual harassment. Her suit alleged that he had propositioned her during a meeting and that he'd spoken of having the power to, quote, make anything happen, end quote, if she understood him, and that they, quote, should have had a sexual relationship a long time ago, end quote. Within weeks, Fox had forced Ailes out, giving him a $40 million severance package. The network apologized to Carlson and paid her a $20 million settlement. Murdoch was slow to see the gravity of the sexual harassment issue, but his two sons, James, the CEO of 21st Century Fox, and Lachlan, its executive chairman, were more responsive. At a board meeting held after the news of Carlson's suit broke, James, the more politically independent of the two, pushed for an outside legal investigation. His demand forced the company to take action, since the notes of the meeting created a public paper trail. Fox's outside law firm, Paul Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison, began an inquiry and exposed an appalling culture of sexual harassment, intimidation, payoffs, and cover-ups at Fox. Ailes, meanwhile, joined Trump's debate team, further erasing the line between Fox and conservative politicians. Ailes also began developing a plan to go into business with Trump. The Sunday before the election, Ailes called Steve Bannon, Trump's campaign chairman, and said that he'd been talking with Trump about launching Trump TV, a nationalist competitor to Fox. Ailes was so excited that he was willing to forfeit his severance payment from Fox, which was attached to a non-compete agreement. He asked Bannon to join the venture and to start planning it as soon as Trump lost the election. "What are you talking about?" Bannon recalls replying. "We're going to win." Stop the BS, Ailes responded. It's going to be a blowout. It'll be over by 8 o'clock. Any hopes that Fox would clean house after Ailes' departure vanished on August 12, 2016, when Fox named two of Ailes' loyalists as co-presidents, Jack Abernathy, an executive who managed Fox's local stations, and Bill Shine. The opinion side of Fox News, which Shine had run, had won out, as had his friend, Sean Hannity. After Ailes was ousted, Murdoch, then 85, assumed the title of acting CEO of Fox News and moved into Ailes' corner office on the second floor of News Corp's Manhattan headquarters. Lachlan and James wanted their father to hire an outsider with journalistic experience to run the channel, but Murdoch, who still thinks of himself as a newsman at heart, couldn't resist filling the top slot himself. The following winter, Murdoch slipped while on Lachlan's yacht, seriously injuring his back. For months, people close to the family say he was in very bad shape, convalescing at home in L.A. Ken LaCourte, the former Fox executive, says that Murdoch shouldn't be discounted because of his age. Well, he's definitely got all his marbles and is 100% sharp. When it came to numbers like ratings, revenues, GDP growth, you name it, he's like a savant. If you made a mistake with a number, he'd usually catch and correct it. But a Fox insider told me that Murdoch was, quote, gone a lot, and adding, he's old. He likes the idea that he's running it, but the lunatics took over the asylum. When Shine assumed command at Fox, the 2016 campaign was nearing its end, and Trump and Clinton were all but tied. That fall, a FoxNews.com reporter had a story that put the network's journalistic integrity to test. Diana Falzone, who often covered the entertainment industry, had obtained proof that Trump had engaged in a sexual relationship in 2006 with a pornographic film actress calling herself Stormy Daniels. Falzone had worked on the story since March, and by October she had confirmed it with Daniels through her manager at the time, Gina Rodriguez, and with Daniels' former husband, Mike Maz, who described multiple calls from Trump. Falzone had also amassed emails between Daniels' attorney and Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, detailing a proposed cash settlement accompanied by a non-disclosure agreement. Falzone had even seen the contract. But Falzone's story didn't run. It kept being passed off from one editor to the next. After getting one noncommittal answer after another from her editors, Falzone at last heard from LaCourte, who was then the head of FoxNews.com. Falzone told colleagues that LaCourte said to her, "Good reporting, kiddo, but Rupert wants Donald Trump to win, so just let it go." LaCourte denies telling Falzone this, but one of Falzone's colleagues confirms having heard her account at the time. Despite the discouragement, Falzone kept investigating and discovered that the National Enquirer, in partnership with Trump, had made a, quote, catch-and-kill, end quote, deal with Daniels, buying the exclusive rights to her story in order to bury it. Falzone pitched this story to Fox, too, but it went nowhere. News of Trump's payoffs to silence Daniels and Cohen's criminal attempts to conceal them as legal fees remained unknown to the public until the Wall Street Journal broke the story a year after Trump became president. In January 2017, Fox demoted Falzone without explanation. That May, she sued the network. Her attorney, Nancy Erica Smith, declined to comment but acknowledged that a settlement had been reached. It includes a non-disclosure agreement that bars Falzone from talking about her work at Fox. After the Journal story broke, Oliver Darcy, a senior media reporter for CNN, published a piece revealing that Fox had killed a Stormy Daniels story. LaCourte, who by then had left Fox but was still being paid by the company, told Mediate that he'd made the call without talking to superiors. The story simply hadn't passed muster, he claimed, adding, I didn't do it to protect Donald Trump. Nick Ritchie, a blogger who had broken the first story about Daniels, tweeted, This is complete BS. Ken, you are such a liar, in all caps. This story got killed by at Fox News at the highest level. I know because I was one of your sources. Ritchie told me, Fox News was culpable. I voted for Trump, and I like Fox, but they did their own catch and kill on the story to protect him. He said that he'd worked closely with Falzone on the article and that she did her homework. She had it. He says he warned her that Fox would never run it, but when they killed it, she was devastated. Ritchie believes that the story would have swayed the election. Isles and a small group kept a close eye on internal talent. We had a file on pretty much everyone, the former Fox executive said, adding that Ailes talked about putting hits in the media on anyone who got out of line. If a woman complained about being sexually harassed, he said that Shine or other supervisors intimidated her into silence, reduced her airtime, or discontinued her contract. The former executive recalls, Shine would talk to the woman with a velvet glove, saying, Don't worry about it. And if that didn't work, he'd warn her it would ruin her career. Shine's defenders maintain that he was unfairly tarnished by Ailes' harassment scandals. He was a victim of sexual McCarthyism, LaCourt told me. Van Susteren notes that Shine was, quote, never accused of compromising behavior. He was accused of looking the other way. He's one of those people in management who put out fires. These people often get themselves burned. But at least four civil lawsuits against Fox have named Shine as a defendant for enabling workplace harassment. One of these cases, a stockholder lawsuit that Fox settled in 2017 for $90 million, claimed that Ailes had sexually harassed female employees and contributors with impunity for at least a decade by surrounding himself with loyalists, including Shine. The suit faults Fox for spending $55 million to settle such claims out of court. The use of company funds for payoffs prompted a criminal investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. In 2017, Shine was subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury, but instead he agreed to be interviewed by prosecutors. The criminal investigation seems to have been dropped after Ailes' death, but Judd Bernstein, an attorney whose client was interviewed by prosecutors, told me, I don't think someone can be a serial sexual abuser in a large organization without enablers like Shine. In 2011, Fox paid a news booker named Lori Loon $3.15 million to keep silent about two decades of sexual mistreatment by Ailes. A copy of the confidentiality agreement shows that Shine co-signed it. The day that Ailes left Fox, Loon broke her silence. She had sexually serviced Ailes for years, she said, in part because he had blackmailed her with compromising videotapes. According to the stockholder suit, Ailes was abetted by the direct involvement of Shine, who scheduled the encounters as work meetings. After Loon suffered a mental breakdown, the suit says, Shine sought a psychiatrist for her. During this period of distress, Loon claimed Ailes' deputies booked her into a New York hotel. Loon has said that she was required to forward all her emails to Shine for monitoring. A spokesperson for Shine has denied this account and has said that Shine was unaware that Ailes and Loon had a sexual relationship. The former Fox executive is dubious that Shine didn't know and recalls Shine rolling his eyes and saying, Lori Loon, she's a problem. Fox News struggled under Shine's leadership. In January 2017, NBC lured away Megyn Kelly. She has since left NBC. 3 months later, The Times revealed that 21st Century Fox and Bill O'Reilly had paid a total of $13 million to five female employees who had accused him of sexual harassment or inappropriate behavior. At the time, O'Reilly was negotiating a $32 million payment to a sixth accuser. He has dismissed all the accusations. The news sparked advertiser boycotts and street demonstrations, and Fox fired O'Reilly. Shine soon followed him out the door. Hannity had warned that it would be the total end of Fox News if his friend Shine were ousted. But with O'Reilly and Kelly gone, Hannity was in his strongest position yet. He was now Fox's top-rated star and Trump's highest-profile promoter. He'd taken Kelly's 9 p.m. slot and was getting even higher ratings, some 3 million viewers a night. 2 months after Shine left Fox, Hannity became a matchmaker, arranging a dinner with the president at the White House, attended by himself, Shine, and Scaramucci, at the time who was Trump's communications director. Hannity proposed Shine as a top communications official, or even as a deputy chief of staff. A year later, Shine was both. By the time Trump was elected, Murdoch had adeptly improved ties with him. In the summer of 2016, he and his fourth wife, Jerry Hall, joined Trump for a visit to Trump's golf club in Scotland. Murdoch appears to have been wise in securing a rapprochement. Telecommunications is a highly regulated industry, and under Trump, the government has consistently furthered Murdoch's business interests to the detriment of his rivals. Hunt, the former FCC chairman, told me that there have been three moves that have been taking place in the regulatory and antitrust world involving telecommunications that are extremely unusual, and the only way to explain them is that they're pro-Fox, pro-Fox, and pro-Fox. Last June, after only 6 months of deliberation, the Trump administration approved Fox's bid to sell most of its entertainment assets to Disney for $71 billion. The Murdoch family will receive more than $2 billion in the deal and will become a major stockholder in the combined company. The Justice Department expressed no serious antitrust concerns, even though the combined company will reportedly account for half the box office revenue in America. Trump publicly congratulated Murdoch even before the Justice Department signed off on the deal and claimed that it would create jobs. In fact, the consolidation is projected to result in thousands of layoffs. In July, the FCC blocked Sinclair Broadcast Group, a conservative rival to Fox, from combining with the Tribune Media Company. The FCC argued that the deal would violate limits on the number of TV stations one entity can own, upending Sinclair's hope of becoming the next Fox. The Justice Department, meanwhile, went to court in an effort to stop AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner, which owns CNN. Time Warner saw the deal as essential to its survival at a time when the media business is increasingly dominated by giant competitors such as Google and Facebook. Murdoch understood this impulse. In 2014, 21st Century Fox had tried, unsuccessfully, to buy Time Warner. For him, opposing his rival's deal was a matter of shrewd business. Trump also opposed the deal, but many people suspected that his objection was a matter of petty retaliation against CNN. Although presidents have traditionally avoided expressing opinions about legal matters pending before the judicial branch, Trump has bluntly criticized the plan. The day after the Justice Department filed suit to stop it, he declared the proposed merger not good for the country. Trump also claimed that he was not going to get involved, and the Justice Department has repeatedly assured the public that he hasn't done so. However, in the late summer of 2017, a few months before the Justice Department filed suit, Trump ordered Gary Cohn, then director of the National Economic Council, to pressure the Justice Department to intervene. According to a well-informed source, Trump called Cohn into the Oval Office, along with John Kelly, who had just become the chief of staff, and said, in exasperation to Kelly, "I've been telling Cohn to get this lawsuit filed and nothing's happened. I've mentioned it 50 times and nothing's happened. I want to make sure it's filed. I want that deal blocked." Cohn, a former president of Goldman Sachs, evidently understood that it would be highly improper for a president to use the Justice Department to undermine two of the most powerful companies in the country as punishment for unfavorable news coverage, and as a reward for competing news organization that boosted him. According to the source, as Cohn walked out of the meeting, he told Kelly, "Don't you effing dare call the Justice Department. We are not going to do business that way." As Murdoch's relations with the White House have warmed, so has Fox's coverage of Trump. During the Obama years, Fox's attacks on the president could be seen as reflecting the adversarial role traditionally played by the press. With Trump's election, the network's hosts went from questioning power to defending it. Yochai Benkler, a Harvard Law School professor who co-directs the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society, says, "Fox's most important role since the election has been to keep Trump supporters in line. The network has provided a nonstop counter-narrative in which the only collusion is between Hillary Clinton and Russia. Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is perpetuating a coup by the deep state. Trump and his associates aren't corrupt, but America's law enforcement officials and courts are. Illegal immigration isn't at a 15-year low. It's at an invasion level. And news organizations that offer different perspectives are enemies of the American people." Binkler's assessment is based on an analysis of millions of American news stories that he and two co-authors, Robert Ferris and Hal Roberts, undertook for their 2018 book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. Binkler told me that he and his co-authors had expected to find symmetric polarization in the left-leaning and the right-leaning media outlets. Instead, they discovered that the two poles of America's media ecosystem function very differently. "It's not the right versus the left," Binkley says. "It's the right versus the rest." Officially, Trump's day begins at 11 a.m. with his national security briefing. But Matt Gaetz, a senior fellow at Media Matters, who has spent more than a year tracking how closely Trump's tweets correspond to Fox News, told me that the real briefing is on Fox and Friends, 4 hours earlier. Judging from the timing of Trump's tweets, Gaetz believes that the president records Fox and Friends and views it from the beginning, often with a slight delay. As Trump watches, he frequently posts about points that he agrees with. Since August 2018, Media Matters has tallied more than 200 instances of Trump disseminating Fox News items to his 58 million Twitter followers. "Trump serves as a carnival barker for Fox," Levin says, "giving invaluable promotional help to the channel." Fox hosts sometimes reverse their opinions in order to toe the Trump line. Hannity, who in the Obama era called negotiations with North Korea disturbing, now calls such efforts a huge foreign policy win. But Gaetz has come to believe that Fox drives Trump more than Trump drives Fox. During the recent standoff with Congress over funding for a border wall, Fox anchors and guests repeatedly pushed Trump to reject compromises favored by Republicans in Congress and by his own staff, and to pursue instead an extreme path favored by Fox's core viewers. White House aides confirm that Trump has repeatedly walked away from compromises at the last moment because Fox hosts and guests opposed the deals. Last March, Trump was widely expected to sign an omnibus appropriations bill, thus avoiding a government shutdown. But Mick Mulvaney, his budget director at the time, and Vice President Mike Pence had described it as a done deal. But on March 22nd, Trump became agitated. A former top aide told me, when the evening hosts at Fox lit him up, and the next morning on Fox and Friends, one of the president's most reliable supporters, Peter Hegseth, ripped him. At 8:55 a.m., Trump tweeted that he might veto the bill because it lacked funding for the border wall, in all caps. The former top aide said of Trump's sudden reversal, it was all Fox. Trump's tweet caused panic in Washington. Many members of Congress had left town, and it wasn't clear that enough were present to pass a stopgap spending bill. Defense Secretary James Mattis rushed to the White House and explained to Trump that if he vetoed the bill, funding for U.S. troops would run out at midnight. That afternoon, Trump relented and signed the bill. Mattis prevailed in this instance, but former White House aides and other political players in Washington believe that Trump is more influenced by Fox pundits and guests than by his staff or by the intelligence experts who brief him. Mark Short, who was formerly in charge of congressional relations for the White House, tried to counter the effect by enlisting Republican allies in the House to go on Fox. According to a Senate staffer, one high-profile Republican senator claims that his preferred way of getting the president's ear is by going on Fox. He calls a friendly host and offers to appear on the air. Usually, before he's taken his makeup off in the green room, Trump is calling him. It's the way to get into his head, the Senate staffer says. Gertz is not alone in believing that Fox host played a key part in driving Trump's recent shutdown of the government and his declaration of a national emergency on the southern border. Hannity and Dobbs urged Trump nightly on their shows to make these moves. According to press reports, they also advised Trump personally to do so. On December 19th, with Republicans still in control of both houses of Congress, Trump's staff indicated that he would sign a spending bill with $1.6 billion earmarked for border security. That night, Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh assailed the deal, and the next morning Fox pounded Trump. Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina, a member of the far-right Freedom Caucus, appeared on Fox and Friends, calling the bill not a punt, but a fumble, and warning Trump not to cave. At 7:33 a.m., Hegseth tweeted at Trump, "Don't listen to squish advisors. No wall equals shut it down," in all caps. By the next day, Trump had refused to sign the spending bill, forcing much of the government to shut down. For the next 35 days, Hannity and the other Fox hosts kept cheering Trump on, even as polls showed that the American public was increasingly opposed to the shutdown. Oliver Darcy of CNN says that Democrats, rather than negotiating with Trump, might as well just call Sean Hannity and get him on the phone, adding, "It seems we sort of elected Sean Hannity when we elected Trump." At the White House, Bill Shine, just as he did at Fox, defers to the man he calls the boss. When Trump became irritated by the White House press corps, Shine acted as his enforcer. Disregarding the norms protecting press freedom, he tried to strip the aggressive CNN White House correspondent Jim Acosta of his White House pass. He also attempted to disinvite the CNN correspondent Caitlin Collins from covering a Rose Garden event. She had annoyed the president earlier that day with a question about Michael Cohen. Schein also berated Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for The Times, after hearing inaccurately that Baker, at a summit in Buenos Aires, had laughed when Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe congratulated Trump on his historic victory in the midterm elections. A source close to Trump says that the president has been complaining that Schein hasn't been aggressive enough. Late last year, Trump told the source, "Schein promised me my press conference would get better, but it's gotten worse." And the source says, "Trump thought he was getting Roger Ailes, but instead he got Roger Ailes' gopher." In recent months, Schein has practically ended White House press briefings. Trump prefers to be his own spokesman. "He always thought he did it the best," a former senior White House official says. "But the problem is that you lose deniability. It's become a trapeze act with no net, 24/7. The shutdown messaging was a crisis. There was no exit strategy." After Fox completes the spinoff of its entertainment properties to Disney, the news channel will be part of a much smaller company under the day-to-day supervision of Lachlan Murdoch. Like Rupert, Lachlan is a conservative, but there's talk around Fox that he may want to bring the news network closer to the center-right. The biggest test yet of Fox's journalistic standards is the impending showdown over Mueller's findings. For 2 years, the network has been priming its viewers to respond with extraordinary anger should the country's law enforcement authorities close in on the president. According to Media Matters, in the first year after Mueller was appointed, Hannity alone aired 486 segments attacking the federal criminal investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. 38% of those segments claimed that law enforcement officials had broken the law. In recent weeks, Hannity has spoken of a coup, and a guest of Laura Ingraham's program, the lawyer Joseph DeGeneva, declared, "It's going to be total war, and as I say to my friends, I do two things, I vote and I buy guns." Jerry Taylor, the co-founder of the Niskanen Center, a think tank in Washington for moderates, says, "In a hypothetical world without Fox News, if President Trump were to be hit hard by the Mueller report, it would be the end of him. But with Fox News covering his back, with the Republican base, he has a fighting chance because he has something no other president in American history has ever had at his disposal, a servile propaganda operation." Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Until next time.